It's good to see you all. I don't know if you've noticed, but it seems like every few years, the world is coming to an end. Have you noticed that? Recently, it was the Mayan calendar was going to kill us all. And it hasn't been long now, if you remember a few years back, that Harold Camping let us know that the Lord would Lord would return and the world would end in 2011. The Lord was coming in May, and the end of the earth was in October. And he was pretty sure about this. And his claims set in motion a countdown to those dates. And leading up until May, his ideas were discussed and debated. Television news anchors became Bible scholars. And we waited to see if he was right. And actually, for most of us, waited to see that he was really a lunatic. Confirmation. Obviously, the world didn't end in 2011. And as far as I can tell, Jesus didn't come back. And Harold Camping has pretty much faded from memory, except for the occasional sermon illustration. But for all the lunacy, he renewed the call to readiness for the Lord's return. And there is something good about that. And the music today, the collect, the scriptures speak of the Lord's return and call us to readiness. Are we ready? How ready do we need to be? Some thoughtful people concerned for Christian pet owners, maybe you've heard this, have been advertising post-rapture pet care. I know Amanda's going to like this. For a small fee, you can be assured of your pet's well-being when Jesus comes back and takes you away. And who will look after these apocalyptically abandoned pets, you might wonder? Well, of course, it will be certified atheists and other non-Christian religious people. Somehow, I don't think that's what Jesus had in mind when he told this parable, the parable we read this morning from Matthew. The dogs are going. This parable is part of a larger discourse in the Gospel of Matthew in which Jesus is calling his followers to readiness for his return at an unknown time. Keep watch, he says, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. Be ready, he warns, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. After that, in the passage preceding our text, he tells a story about a wicked servant who assumed his master would be away on a journey a long time, and so begins to beat his fellow servants and do terrible things. And Jesus says, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour when he is not aware. The message here is be ready because the Lord could come soon. And now to illustrate the point from the reverse, Jesus tells this story about 10 bridesmaids. What would have been familiar and commonplace in Jesus' day is somehow strange and unfamiliar to us. Apparently, there isn't a lot known now about the customs and the things that happened around Jewish weddings in the first century. And it may help, actually, a little bit if you know the fiddler on the roof, and you can imagine the wedding scene with the guests standing around with candles and the bride and the groom under the canopy. What would probably have been typical, though, would be the bride and her party waiting in her father's house for the groom and his party to come and take her back to his house. And this would have most likely taken place at night and been the kickoff of 7 days of celebration, beginning with a great banquet. And bridesmaids, like those found in Jesus' story, had the important task of lighting the way. And in some sense, this was a preparation for their own wedding day. Well, even if the details are a little unclear, we can be fairly certain that weddings were a big deal from what is written of them. They would have been community events. We may not have much sense of this now in the Western world, but in many parts of the world, this is still the case. And in Rwanda, there is something called, it's a dowry ceremony, essentially, that still takes place today. It still takes place in the bride's village, and many times the whole community is present. A wedding in this sense is an occasion in which cultural dynamics, for example, honor and shame, are in play. It would have been a great honor to assist the bride on her wedding day. And it would have brought great shame to have failed in this role. I think this is what's behind the statement of the groom when the foolish bridesmaids finally arrive. "Truly I tell you, I do not know you." They have dishonored him and his bride, so they will suffer the inevitable shame of rejection and exclusion from the joy of the wedding. Well, if all of this seems a little foreign to us, a little different from our weddings, Jesus' intention is at least clear. The bridesmaids are sent out to wait for the groom. The wise among them go prepared. The foolish do not. When he delays, those who had prepared were ready, but the unprepared were not. The point comes in verse 13 at the end. "Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour." Jesus is calling his followers to readiness. Well, how do we wait for something that seems a long time in coming? You may know that our daughter Nora, now about a month old, was about 10 days delayed in her birth. She was 10 days past due. And we were ready on that due date, at least mostly. Bags were packed, the car was packed, plans were made. But the further we got from the date, the more our readiness slipped. We started to say things like, "Wouldn't it be nice to have one more good night's sleep? One more weekend, one more Sunday in church." Or things that had been packed were taken out because they were needed or something. And well-laid plans were thrown up for more of a "let's see what happens" attitude. So being ready for that which is delayed is not easy. It doesn't happen accidentally, that's for sure. There is much that distracts us. So how do we keep ready for the Lord's return, even if it's a long time in coming? What do we do? I'm sure there are actually multiple ways to address that question. And actually this morning, I would simply like to look at the passages in addition to Matthew, to see what the lectionary readings offer us by way of wisdom for the wise. So there are three passages, and I'll make 3 points, I think. You may find others. First of all, we may not be ready, because we are ignorant of what the Lord is doing. So we keep ready by being faithful to what he has commanded. Amos prophesied in the midst of heightened expectation for the Lord's coming to judge the nations. God was coming, but as we read in Amos, the people were unprepared. They did not know what to expect. The day of the Lord meant judgment for those in Israel as well, who lived large, while the innocent and the poor and the needy suffered. And so Amos, wanting to prepare God's people and wake them from that ignorance, declared, "Woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Why do you long for the day of the Lord? That day will be darkness, not light." But they simply couldn't see it. They couldn't see what was coming. I think we Christians can be similarly ignorant in some ways, unprepared for what God is doing, unknowing of who he is. Annie Dillard writes, "On the whole, I do not find Christians outside the catacombs sufficiently sensible of conditions. Does anyone have the foggiest idea what sort of power we so blithely invoke? The churches are children playing on the floor with their chemistry sets, mixing up a batch of TNT to kill a Sunday morning. It is madness to wear ladies' straw hats to church. We should all be wearing crash helmets. Ushers should issue life preservers and signal flares. They should lash us to our pews. For the sleeping God may awake someday and take offense, or the waking God may draw us out to where we cannot return. Being unprepared is a problem, but it's not an excuse. The real solution for Israel's ignorance was in faithfulness. Amos calls them to covenant fidelity with their God. It meant doing right by the poor and the oppressed. It required an act of heart, not simply repetition of rituals. Obedience was required, and it still is. As we wait for the Lord, we should be doing what we know is required of us. We may be ignorant of what the Lord is doing at times. We may not know for sure, but we can do what we know He's called us to do. So where might the Lord be calling us to obedience now? In our culture today, there is not a high value on rest. This is an example, I think. Most Christians would probably agree that when Jesus comes back, we should be found doing His work, being busy for Him. It would seem countercultural for keeping the Sabbath to be an act of readiness. But what if the Lord came and found us resting? Perhaps that is being ready. Secondly, we may not be ready because we are forgetful. So we keep ready by telling the story. Psalm 78, which is a much longer psalm than the part we read this morning, but this psalm recounts a pattern in Israel's story, a pattern in which forgetfulness leads to unfaithfulness. It is this pattern that the psalmist wishes to break for the next generation. By retelling the story, they would remember and not forget. The psalmist summons the people to hear the old stories so that they will, in his words, tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, His power and the wonders He has done. And knowing what the Lord has done, they would put their trust in God. It would not forget His deeds. They would not be like their ancestors, a stubborn and rebellious generation. So when we rehearse the story of God's past faithfulness, we keep ourselves alert to His faithfulness in the present, and we anticipate His future faithfulness. In this way, we remind ourselves of our place in that story as well. Now, I know that it can be dangerous today in our world to talk about a meta-narrative, a story that everyone should fit into. And no one wants to have a story imposed on them other than their own. And there is, I think, a value in resisting pushing people into that. There's a TED Talk by a woman named Chimamanda, and she talks about just this thing. The danger of a single story. Narratives of white children playing in the snow have nothing to do with kids in Nigeria. And so having only one story about ourselves or about others can be dangerous and lead to misunderstandings or worse. But the biblical narrative is, I think, big enough to include us all because it begins at creation. And even in the particulars, even where it narrows to one person, like Abraham, it still includes everyone. It's still meant to. All of our personal stories find meaning in God's big story. I personally like detective shows. Maybe you do too. And I've been watching one in which a crime novelist teams up with a homicide detective. And they seem like an unlikely duo, at least at first. But what we discover in their partnership is that he is able to take bits and pieces of evidence and tell the story that that evidence speaks to, tell the story behind it, the story of the murder. And in a moment, I think of television greatness, he says, there is a story that makes sense. Sorry, there is a story that makes everything else make sense. The biblical story is that story for us and for our world. And I think this is the beauty of our worship every week. We tell the story of God in both word and sacrament. We hear each week bits of God's grand narrative in the scriptures and in the sermon. And each week we rehearse the story of our redemption through Christ in the Eucharist. Worship tells the story and anticipates what is still to come. And it invites us in. It invites all people in to participate. So we ready ourselves by telling and retelling the story. Imagine if the bridesmaids had been telling the story of the wedding to each other. They might have been ready. Third, finally, we may not be ready because of grief. We keep ready by living the resurrection. And I think in this way we balance the first point. If that sounded too much like just do the right thing, this is God's making you into his person. Or you have the balance of rules and transformation. One of Paul's primary concerns, maybe the whole reason he wrote 1 Thessalonians, is that the church be prepared for the coming of the Lord. But the Thessalonians have become distracted from readiness because of grief. And Paul seeks to encourage the church that those who have died before Christ returns will not miss his coming. They won't miss out because they've passed away. Notice that Paul does not say, though, that he does not want them to grieve. Rather, they are not to grieve as those without hope. So this is not about overcoming grief necessarily, but grieving in hope. The Thessalonians can have hope because those who have died, they can have hope because of the resurrection of Christ, which Paul connects to the second coming of Christ as well as the resurrection of all believers. They can take heart because Christ's resurrection is the guarantee of the resurrection of their fellow Christians and the guarantee of his coming back. But what I think Paul says here has some broader implications for us. Like the Thessalonians, we sometimes get lost or immobilized by grief. Grief because of death, pain, the brokenness in our lives and in our relationships. These things distract us in a way from our readiness. We may look at the world at times and lose hope. But the resurrection is the answer to all the brokenness in the world. Death being one example, the resurrection of Christ is only the beginning of a world made new, of all things being made right. It is the promise of restoration and reconciliation for everything. And so in the face of all this brokenness and corruption, we have hope in the resurrection. But it's not simply hope as a mental exercise. We live the resurrection life here and now as a witness that in the words of the old prayer, things which were cast down are being raised up, and things which had grown old are being made new. This has begun already in us. All of us. Those of us who have died and risen with Christ. And so in the words of Wendell Berry, practice resurrection. When we practice what we are becoming, we ready ourselves for the Lord's return. Now that might sound sort of abstract. In other places, Paul talks about being meek and being humble, putting on Christ, loving one another, humility, gentleness, forgiveness. I think that's what it means to practice resurrection. Three passages, three ways of readying ourselves, keeping ready in the face of the unknown coming of Christ. When we practice faithfulness, when we retell the story, when we live resurrection, we keep ready. Now, and I'm almost done. In the spirit of last week's sermon, and it's not every week that I come to church thinking I need a sermon on hypocrisy, but sometimes we do. In the spirit of that week's sermon, I need to be honest. Because having said all this, I don't want you to look at me and think, hey, there's a model of readiness. Because in many ways, I don't feel ready. Honestly. I'm distracted. I'm busy with so many things. And I find it hard to get ready for the morning. I find it hard to get ready for a return to Rwanda. How am I supposed to get ready for the Lord's return? These things hopefully are a pointer forward. So where do we start? Where do any of us start? I think we can begin where we began this message, in the parable Jesus told. Someone once said, all acts performed in the world begin in the imagination. So let's imagine ourselves as wise bridesmaids, sent out to meet the groom when he comes. And knowing that he may delay, let's imagine ourselves being ready, taking what we need so that we are prepared, so that we might meet him in readiness and enter with him the joy of the banquet. Imagine there are two kinds of people in the world, those who are ready and those who are not. Now be ready. Amen.